Last week, we began to unpack the meaning of spiritual integrity as a capacity to become complicated. And one way in which we are complicated is to understand who we are to be in living out our promises to one another, to the world. We heard James Baldwin last week, who wrote about integrity. There is such a thing as integrity, he said. Some people are noble. There is such a thing as courage. The terrible thing is that the reality behind these words ultimately depends on what the human being, meaning every single one of us, believes to be real. The terrible thing is that the reality behind all these words depends on choices one has got to make forever and ever and ever. The nature of the everyday seems to have changed dramatically for some of us. Those with salary jobs or inherited wealth right now are experiencing immense amounts of comparative privilege or security, while COVID-19 has laid bare the inherent violence, cruelty, and inequality of racial capitalism. The racial wealth gap is widening. For example, in May, the unemployment rate in the United States dropped for white workers, but went up for Black workers. But this kind of inequality is not news. Economic opportunity, just as economic fallout, has been unfairly distributed across racial groups forever. In terms of home ownership, stock ownership, student debt, net worth, meritocracy has always been a lie. When we control for other factors, education, location, discrimination by opportunity persists. And here we are, as the unemployment boost has expired and the next phase of relief for Americans during this pandemic has yet to be seen or known or decided. Even with a relief package extension, economic policies are not neutral based on race. The disparities caused and continued by prior policy and legal decisions means we can't assume that additional support will make a difference in alleviating existing inequality. And here we are, as racism and policing and police violence takes national spotlight again, and as a community of faith, we say amen to uprising and scan. At George Floyd's Minneapolis memorial service, the civil rights leader, Reverend Al Sharpton, analogized that the widespread systemic injustice against Black Americans is akin to the officer's knee held against Floyd's neck during his Memorial Day arrest. Most people, I would say, recognize that these disparities exist. If Black lives matter, then what do I do next? How do we participate in the turning towards liberation as individuals, as a community? The terrible thing about integrity is, James Baldwin wrote, is knowing about the injustice, educating ourselves on what we did not know or what we did not fully understand. Networks or the chambers of Congress who perpetuate myths about poverty and the meaning, the use of social support. The terrible thing is that the reality behind these words depends on choices one has got to make forever and ever, every day. Integrity does not accept partial progress. And so it continues. The big ask of spiritual integrity may be this: equipped with our self-knowledge and the facts about economic inequality, what are we going to do about it? The choice to bless the world is more than an act of will. Rebecca Parker writes, a moving forward into the world with the intention to do good. We choose to bless the world. At a general level, the redistribution of wealth is about investing in communities. It's about backing children's futures. It's about having a vision of multiple generations, of multiracial society when it comes to how we think about money, even when it's hard to imagine just what 2021 will look like for us personally, or as a gathering faith community, or as a society. The redistribution of wealth is a sharing of risk so that all of us, including those from whom wealth would be drawn down, including, yes, the middle class, have our needs met, have security and access to health. Redistributing wealth is about transfers of income and wealth and property from some individuals to others, to put it simply. And there are lots of proposals and models of how to enact this form of change. And I am not naive that it is a complicated and controversial subject. For the class conversations, which educates Unitarian Universalists about class awareness and inclusion, empowering our religious movement to dismantle classism within our congregations and communities. I serve as their West Coast trainer. It's mostly East Coast group, and on their steering committee. We encourage class consciousness in congregations that will help UUs to take action to counter racial economic inequality. We see the connection between racism in our world, economic inequality in our systems, and our attitudes towards one another, our comforts with our own class privilege or class disadvantage within our congregations. Unitarian Universalist is considered one of the most progressive faith communities, as well as one of the most class advantaged when it comes to the matrix of income, property, and education. People along the class spectrum can find themselves feeling profoundly isolated, even within Unitarian Universalist congregations, which we hope are places of love and inclusion for all. Add to this the fact that the American culture, particularly middle and owning class culture, talking about money and about class is considered taboo. This fact only deepens our struggle to talk to one another, to hear one another, and to engage across difference and similarities of class as a social justice faith issue. The religious right knows how to spend their money on values or in ways that protect billionaires. In movements for justice, we can sometimes feel the sting of that fact, but there are people with progressive values who have access to more than they are comfortable admitting. There are collectives of congregations, clusters of people who have access to wealth that could be redistributed, that have the ability to mobilize resources, power, communication, to change economic inequality. These feelings, the feelings about that make it hard for us to speak out, to talk about the redistribution of wealth outside of maybe a liberal bubble, about asking for structural or policy change that redistributes wealth, it can be uncomfortable to admit that our protections from things like COVID-19, regardless of age, family structure, or health conditions, is based on our access to money. In UUism, what we find as trainers in congregations is that our UU congregational membership have difficulty talking about one's access to wealth, just as much as we have difficulty talking about our experiences of poverty. The organization Resource Generation organizes young people under 35 who have access to wealth for social justice, philanthropy, and advocacy. And they describe what having wealth means. Those with wealth have benefited financially from an economic system that accumulates wealth by stealing the land, labor, and lives of poor people, indigenous people, Black people, and people of color. For all humans, Earth, and all its inhabitants to heal, especially the most exploited, reparations and repair on all levels is necessary. Making a commitment to wealth redistribution often means going up against a society and family norms, committing to transform ourselves in the process, to find a ways to value ourselves, value safety in our relationships and community, and not always in bank accounts. Resource generation trains young people with wealth on how to create giving pledges that make significant and meaningful contributions towards building the world we long for and moving from investment in a current system toward living in connection with our values. And of course, this kind of wealth redistribution is not just for young people. Chuck Collins, a middle-aged UU in Massachusetts, gave away his inherited wealth and shares in a podcast about what it meant to be a person raised in the 1% and to give away claims to inherit future inheritance, to give them in a sign, in a gesture of what it could mean to redistribute wealth in our unequal society. Recently, you probably read the articles about Mackenzie Scott's pledge to give the majority of her own wealth back to the society that helped generate it until the safe is empty, she said. There's no question in her mind that anyone's personal wealth is the product of collective effort and of social structures that provide opportunities to some people and obstacles to countless others. Even if you don't believe it will end inequality in the future, wealth redistribution now may be the only way to correct the wrongs, to revise what has not been earned in society that has relied on colonization, slavery, or exploitation, to pad the pockets of a very few and enable the relative safety of many more, of me. I will admit I'm learning about what this means for me, what in practical terms it would mean to turn to my own giving and double it. Resource Generation has found that among their members, the pledging, joining others in ending the death machine of our racial and economic system makes an incredible difference. It means that members of a broader community can name the financial support needed by Black and Brown-led movements for justice, and those of us who are members of broader community groups can ask ourselves questions about how we invest and budget and the match between our principles and our collective pockets. If we share in this together, as an organization, as a congregation, as a family, especially in pandemic times, the call for change, structural and political, doesn't feel quite as scary or vulnerable. We can call upon our leaders to ensure paid sick leave for all workers. We can take our own pledge to help redistribute wealth by debunking the myths about poverty, about direct giving, about abundance. We can take these to our ballots. We can take these to our neighbors. Perhaps the most difficult thing that happens when we speak from our own faith-held beliefs about wealth and inequality is when we encounter fear, our own and others. This fear can come through as denial or false hope. I'm hearing a lot of that now in the news, on social media, and among people of faith, including moments within my own fear. Things like things are going to get back, are going to start to get better economically, or soon things will get back to normal. Or good, honest business people who there are going to be those who are going to use their skills to help us recover. Historically, this has not been the case. If the latter had been the case, we'd have a lot more wins for racial justice under our belt, wouldn't we? Major companies would not have made a killing on the 5 million COVID cases across the United States. We might hear from others or hear ourselves say, well, that's just the way it is. I'm not sure that I could do anything about it. These things are beyond me. I'll just do what I can to love the people where I am. Reverend Dr. William Barber II, who I spoke about last week, wrote a book, The Third Reconstruction, which tells the story of the beginning of the revival of the Poor People's Campaign. He also details the backlash, the death threats, and the rage of the elite under out of control. When we're fed spin, the things that will get better, and then they don't. Poor people and working class people are informed that possibly they might be doing something wrong. For those of us who might have access to wealth or class privilege, we might think our job is to protect what we have. We may fail to acknowledge the layers of the safety net where it exists, where it fails. Fear can also whisper convincingly that there's little we can do. I think our separation in this virus has something to do with this fear of or this powerlessness. The Poor People's Campaign have said there is fear also because there is resistance. But resistance can be our confirmation that we're on the right track. In Reverend Dr. Barber's theology, God is on the side of the oppressed. And so resistance to the call for care for the rejected can be confirmation that we are on the right track. When Reverend Dr. Barber was organizing in North Carolina in the early 2000s, he knew very, very few outside of the state knew what was going on in his organizing movement, in their ability to build coalitions and power to get inequality on the government agenda. We knew we were witnessing something historic, though our deepest moral convictions told us this was right. We had little external affirmation. They say seeing is believing, but the truth is that people with power will ignore what they do not want to see as long as we let them, he writes. We who believe in freedom and justice must remember the summary of nonviolent struggle often attributed to Gandhi. First they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. Redistribution of wealth is not a popular notion, but it doesn't mean it's not possible. It doesn't mean that our own actions will not have an effect. When I say let's redistribute wealth, when leaders say let's implement a billionaire tax, when people say let's have a living wage, not a minimum wage, well, we might be at the laugh at you stage, edging sometimes towards the they fight you stage that Gandhi was talking about. But faith-rooted moral battle, UU moral battle, is upon the shoulders of Unitarian Universalists who raged against racist violence and economic inequality before my time, faced resistance, including from within UU congregations and among UU leaders. But it didn't mean that they were wrong. We have a 2017 statement on conscience on the rising inequality that has asked us to confront it, ratified by a General Assembly. Even if people may disagree with our convictions, it doesn't mean we are wrong. If bringing the good news of sustenance, health, and dignity to all people through tangible, material means is divisive politics and not religion, will just take my soul away. We do not become Unitarian Universalists, we do not claim a UU faith to find compromise. Just because there is an opposition to justice doesn't mean we are wrong. It just means our principles are powerful enough not to be dismissed. A heavy backlash, Barbara continues, against our movement for justice might hurt. It might make us weep and moan. It might scare us, but it must not deter us. In fact, it should encourage us, because resistance is our confirmation that we're on the right track. So when we have conversations about redistributing wealth, debunking hateful myths about poverty and aid in our community, whether it's on Facebook or in the grocery store or at our family's, our extended family's dinner party or Zoom call, we have to be ready to reframe the backlash for ourselves, to check in with those who have pledged with us, to do what we can wherever we can to combat inequality. Our seven UU principles of UUism, I feel, may have had a honeymoon period. The principles themselves are almost 40 years old. Whether we have been born into the faith or come into it later in life, our partnership with these principles is not value neutral. While we draw from and invite in different theological pathways, different sources, we do have a shared morality that does not agree with every position available. When we face backlash, we have an opportunity to come back together as UUs, as community, and grow deeper in our connection to one another and into understanding our collective agency in this situation. To use Rebecca Parker's words in a closing, your gifts, whatever you discover them to be, can be used to bless or curse the world. Any of these can serve to feed the hungry, or any of these can be used to draw down the prison door, hoard bread, or bind up wounds, abandon the poor, welcome the stranger, praise what is sacred, or obscure what is holy. Do the work of justice or comply with injustice. Withhold or offer love. We choose to bless the world, and we can choose the integrity of our souls. May justice prevail. May we offer love. May we be the community we need to be, so that we can feel the spiritual integrity that our principles demand, that we can make tangible change. Thank you.